liebe Hörerinnen und Hörer einer weiteren Folge der Interviews for Future, dem Podcast der Scientists for Future, heute auf Englisch. Hello dear listeners to podcast for Scientists for Future Leipzig, the Interviews for Future. Today it's about carbon offset, and I'm say hello to Stephanie Akusa. Hello, Stephanie.
Hi, Dominique. Thank you for having me on today.
Yeah, thank you to join our podcast. So you are at Arizona State University, and they're in the Center of Negative Carbon Emissions, so climate scientist in general, with a view exactly on those emissions. Is there something else important for us to know, or you wanted to tell us?
Yeah, I can tell you just a little bit about the mission of the center, which is to advance the science, policy, and technology of carbon management in general.
Okay, so that's where we go, because carbon management in the end is how to deal with it. And I know it from my side. So if I took a bus, or I don't fly, but if I took a bus or like this a public bus for longer travel or those things, or you order something from internet, you can press this button, make my emissions away, thanks, for 10 cent or half an euro. And that's called carbon offset. In general, can you bring us a bit more detailed what's meant by carbon offset?
Yeah, absolutely. So a carbon offset really refers to a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions or an increase in carbon storage, and that is used to compensate for emissions that occur elsewhere. And the basic idea is that the greenhouse gas emissions are mixed throughout the atmosphere, so it doesn't matter where the reduction would happen, it's all the same. And so one would purchase a carbon offset, like you mentioned, to compensate for the production of emissions due to an activity. You gave the example of the bus, could be a flight, it could be the purchase of a product, it could be anything that produced an emission. And these offsets are meant to be transferable instruments that are certified by governments or by independent certification bodies. And they really represent that emission reduction in terms of tons of CO2 equivalent.
You said that it's told that all those gases are mixed in the atmosphere, so it's doesn't depend where it's you pollute there, and on another part of planet you make a sink. It's in Germany, a sink, I would say, maybe it's the right word for a carbon sink. Is it true? Is this has it no effect, or only a little one?
Well, so that is the basic idea, but in actual practice it gets a little bit more complicated, because an emission in a certain country does not mean the same in another country, right? There are some implications to how the system works. And this also applies to what kind of sinks we're talking about. So whether we're doing carbon removal from technology into, I don't know, a geological storage, for example, or whether it's in a forest, all of this matters. And so the mantra of a ton is a ton may not be exactly correct.
Okay, so for someone who is not really in this topic, so I would say, okay, sounds nice. So maybe my flight is polluting 3 tons, but they produce a carbon sink or like this of maybe 4 tons or 5 tons if I give a bit more money. So I did a flight and did good thing for the climate in the end. So, but you say no, it's not a solution like it sounds. Why it's it not a solution?
Yeah, and I guess the first thing I really want to make clear is all of those activities that these offsets are doing, these are important things that we should be doing for climate action. So if an offset is, you know, the expansion of renewable energy or the capture and destruction of methane or avoided deforestation or energy efficiency, all of those things are so important for climate action. The problem starts to happen when we try to credit those activities. And then when we try to use those credits to compensate for an emission that is produced elsewhere, that is where the disconnect starts to happen. This is where the problems start to emerge. And those problems are the result of issues related to the big idea of carbon offsets and carbon management in general, as well as the methods that are used to create the offsets.
You said credit. Credit is nothing physical. It's only an idea in the end. I give you a credit in money. I don't give you money. I don't give you the thing you buy from it. Maybe let's start with an example where I pay for, I have this credit, I do it official, I pay for it, but the effect is no result, so that my flight is still only polluting.
Yeah, so let me kind of explain this on two different grounds. The first one is about the idea that we can neutralize an emission with a reduction. Right. So you gave the example. I took a flight. I went from Phoenix to Paris to go home, see my family. It produced 650 kilograms of CO2. Now I go on the website and I purchase a carbon offset for this amount of CO2. Well, up to now, the idea that an emission reduction elsewhere would neutralize my emissions was okay, because we had this idea that we must just reduce emissions. But the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has made very clear that we have a remaining carbon budget, a finite total allowance of carbon that we can emit or should stay within if we don't want to cross the 1.5 or the 2 degrees Celsius Paris Agreement commitments. So, for example, in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report that just came out, the total remaining carbon budget for an 87% chance of staying within 1.5 degree of warming was 300 gigatons of carbon. So that is the total amount that remains. And if we partition that to the number of people on Earth, that's like 39 tons per person remaining forever, right? And so now comes carbon offsets. These offsets, I'm producing emissions, but the offsets are just representing emissions not produced elsewhere, but I have still produced emissions. And so even if it was a perfect offset, I would still have produced one ton of emission. And this is then reducing the amount of carbon that we have left in the carbon budget. So that's really the first fundamental issue with using carbon offsets. They are eating the budget that we have. And that's in the best case scenario, when the offset works perfectly. In the second kind of type of issue with carbon offsets, is how we produce the carbon offsets may not actually produce a real carbon offset. And that's because carbon offsets represent an additional reduction in emissions. So what we mean by that is that we are not giving a credit for something that would have happened otherwise. Because if it did happen otherwise, that means it is not additional. That means we are not actually creating a reduction. And so in a perfect case, something, a project is built, we can prove that it is additional, and then a credit is created, I purchase the credit, it is compensating for my emission. But the concept of additionality, although is very useful, it is almost incredibly challenging to implement in practice. And that's because it requires something that's called a counterfactual, basically proving that something did not happen. And as the name suggests, you cannot prove that something did not happen, because you, right? Yeah. So you have to create this alternate reality where you say, in this other world, we did not produce this project, and thus it is business as usual. But in this world, we created this project, and so we reduced emissions. And so we are comparing this alternate reality to the current reality, and we say, yes, it is additional, and here's how much emission reduction I have produced. Now, let me give you an example of what this looks like. And maybe I'll give you two examples. The first one is you might have a coal-fired power plant. And in the business as usual scenario, you continue burning your coal-fired plant. In the carbon offset scenario, you say, well, if you pay for this carbon offset, it will help with the installation of scrubbers on my power plants. And the addition of scrubbers will reduce the amount of CO2 that goes in the air. And so I should receive a credit for that. So, and then so you can purchase.
So that the percent of CO2 then comes out.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so you would say, well, the hypothetical scenario is this business as usual, and the current scenario is me installing this scrubber. But to actually prove that this was additional, one would have to know that there is no regulation in place that is currently demanding carbon scrubbers, or that the person owning the power plant did not install the scrubber for another purpose. Right, scrubbers are used also for other types of pollutants, like air pollution. And so one would need to know what the power plant operator, what the intent was. And no one knows that other than the power plant operator. So it becomes very difficult to prove what caused what. Another example that is usually kind of talked about is with credits of avoided deforestation. And those are the most, so, you know, the in terms of volume, those are the most available types of credits. So here the idea is I'm a, you know, a landowner and I have a forest, and I tell you, I will cut down this forest unless you pay me. Right? So the business as usual scenario is, well, everybody is cutting the forest because I can, you know, they can make good money for timber. And so I'm going to cut my forest too because I need the money. But the carbon offset company comes and says, well, we will pay you to keep your forest and we will produce these emission credits. But who's to say I would actually have cut down the forest, right? Who's to say that the timber was actually the reason for cutting down the forest? So it becomes very difficult, again, to tell what is causing what. And so this concept of additionality, you know, makes sense in theory, but in practice, it's just very, very challenging to prove. And so you can buy a carbon offset, but there is a very possible likelihood that it was not additional. Therefore, it did not compensate for your emission and you made climate change worse.
To make it metaphoric, so that I understand right, it's like you have a bar, you're a bar owner or a restaurant owner, and you're working, living there in peace, and I come with a gun and say, okay, give me money to live there in peace or I kill you. In the end, mafia.
So it's a little bit like a ransom, yes.
Okay, if I say, so I have the possibility to make a carbon offset system for all flights in this world with planting trees. Is there enough space on the world to plant those trees?
No, probably not. okay. Not if we consider planting trees where there were no trees before. So when we talk about afforestation, but if we talk about maybe reforestation or forest restoration, then maybe that's a difficult, that's a different story. Over the centuries, we've cut down so many forests and we've really degraded ecosystems. So if we were to restore everything to what it used to be, probably then that would take care of the aviation emissions, but then it wouldn't take care of all the land use emissions, right? So we have to choose. either we restore or we neutralize or whatever the word would be, the emissions we produce from land use change, or we count that towards aviation or some other type of emissions. It can't be both, because then we're double counting.
To bring it in a scale, if these bad examples are the bad examples and there are good examples and there are some between, for sure you can't say it clearly. As you said, there's no really good way to look on it, to watch on it. As you told, where you're standing and this.
Yeah,
is it an industry for bad thing, or is it a...
That's the key question. And there's been a number of studies that try to kind of do those math and see, are we buying more good than bad? And I guess I always return to this study in 2016 by the OCO Institute. So I think, I'm pretty sure that's a German organization. And so they looked at all of the credits that were produced, not all of them, but like a subset of the credits that were produced for a program called the Clean Development Mechanism. This was a Kyoto era, program to create offsets, and, you know, the first one to ever exist. And so they looked at a specific subset for the years 2013 to 2020. And what they found is that of that subset, 85% of the projects had a very low likelihood to to reproduce actual emission reductions, and were likely overestimated. And that translated to something like 73% of the entire supply may be overestimated. So then the question would be, okay, well, is it just that program? And is it better elsewhere? And so I guess then there was another study that came out just this year, actually, from this group called Carbon Plan, who does a lot of research on carbon management in general. And they looked at the California crediting program, which is another regulated carbon market. And there they found that at least 30% of the credits were likely to be overcredited as well. So not as bad, I guess, as the Clean Development Mechanism, but not great either when you consider the quantities that were sold.
Okay, you talked about regulation. So that's a key point in the end. So if carbon offset is regulated, that it could be much better. But how is it? Is it regulated, or how is it regulated? Are there upcoming regulations that help to make it better, or how is this going?
Yeah, so the two programs I mentioned, the Clean Development Mechanism and the California Offset Credit, they're both regulated markets. So I think one of the key lessons.
So the 85% market is a regulated market too.
Mm-hmm. So I think the key lesson for me is that just because it's regulated does not mean it's better. The regulations can also produce things that are questionable. So it's a matter of really rethinking the entire system, I think. And, you know, there's this whole conversation about whether we should be tweaking policies little by little, trying to make them better. And that's the approach that the carbon markets have been taking for the past 30 years. They've been tweaking, trying to make things better. Or there's the opposite argument that says we're running out of time. We need to take a leap and actually design something from the start that is meant to work. And obviously that's a much bigger change. But at the end of the day, if it is as urgent as the IPCC makes it sounds with the reports, we don't have time to keep tweaking until we finally get something that works. So it would be my opinion that we do need to design this overarching framework that really says, if we want carbon offsets to work, this is what they must look like. This is what they must contain. And to me, that means it must be measurable. There must be proof. There is no such thing as using hypothetical scenarios of made up worlds. It must be measurable. So have proof. And that way it can be verified. We can have third party auditors coming in and checking the actual projects and what they're actually doing. And the last part is that a carbon offset must represent only emission removal, not emission reduction. And that's important because of that carbon budget framing.
So,
and once we put these ingredients, then we can start thinking about a framework that would make carbon offsets work from the start.
For example, so I have a land, this size, and I say, okay, I make carbon offset, and it's clear, it's measured, it's regulated that I have for this and that tons I produce, I have to fill this land with, I have to plant here trees. So the trees are standing. And how is this measured? How long they are? Because a tree is not a magic stick that makes chuck, I'm here and these tons are out. It's a time scale that's going there. How's there dealt with?
Yeah, you hit on probably the other most important aspects of carbon removal, which is the so-called durability of storage. How long will the carbon removal project actually store the carbon? And I guess if we look at carbon dioxide from a science perspective, once carbon dioxide is in the atmosphere, a very large percentage of that amount will remain there for hundreds of thousands of years. So when we talk about the problem with carbon dioxide, we're talking about a problem that is literally permanent on human timescales. And so if we want to do carbon removal, it has to be on these kind of very, very long timescales also. Otherwise, it is just like a climate speed bump, right? We take carbon from the air, we put it in storage for a few decades, it comes back out, and the problem continues. So you're really talking about that fundamental question of how do we make sure that the carbon remains sequestered pretty much forever? And you hit the nail on the head. Forests, they won't deliver hundreds of thousands of years, right? And in these carbon offsets that are currently being sold, what we found is that right now, the definition of permanence varies between 10 years and 100 years. So nothing close to what is necessary. So right now there is this definition of permanence that's being used, and they might use some mechanisms to enforce that over that time. They might say you have to monitor. They might say you have to keep a certain percentage of the credits into like an insurance fund. But it doesn't change the fact that after 100 years, the carbon will come back out. So there, in this kind of idea of having an overarching framework, there needs to also be rules about what it means for carbon removal to be permanent. And this has to be really strict, because at the end of the day, the more the rules are relaxed about that feature, the less likely we will reach a state of carbon neutrality, right? If we are going to use all of these offsets of carbon removal to say we're carbon neutral, but half of them are releasing carbon on an annual basis, we will continuously be in that cycle of never reaching carbon neutrality. So there's a real imperative to define durable storage properly.
Yeah, I remember a story I've read some newspapers. I know how exactly it's clear, it's right, but there was a carbon offset. They planted a forest, and then there came a little stupid accident, and the forest took fire. the forest burned down, and another forest that's close to this forest burned down too. The next point is mostly, I don't know how they make it, but mostly for the consumer, they tell we are planting trees. If I remember this summer 2022, I'm only remembering wildfires. So
there is a real problem coming down the line where climate change itself is going to be a very big problem for ecosystems, and relying even more on these ecosystems to capture all of that excess carbon that has been produced from the burning of fossil fuels is going to be a real challenge. And it might also be a very large liability, like the example you said from that offset project that went up in flames. At the end of the day, there is a responsibility there to make sure that, you know, even if that happens, that the project operator took care and remediated the problem. So they would have to go back and re-sequester all of that carbon that they lost. And so relying on these ecosystems to do that kind of sequestration or carbon removal work is going to be more and more difficult as climate changes and impacts ecosystems. But it's true. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, if we imagine like 100 years from now when we've actually solved climate change and we've done everything, we do want a world that is livable with ecosystems that are restored and plentiful and everything. So it still makes sense to do the restoration work and all of the kind of nature solutions that are being talked about. But with the mindset that it's going to get increasingly difficult to rely on those systems for carbon removal, right? And the value of these systems are much, much greater than the carbon they sequester, in my opinion. And I'm sure it's shared by many, right? The value of a tree is not because it stores carbon. The value of a tree is because of many other things. And so there is a real need to question where we're going to put the carbon, because we're talking about humongous, humongous scales of removal.
Yeah, the mindset is an important thing, because in the end, if my mindset is I want to rescue the earth, make it like this, metaphoric or directly, then I really put much thoughts in where I plant what. The carbon offset, so let's make it clear, is an money-making industry, and we all know it. Or maybe is it right? Is it a money-making industry?
In many ways, it's difficult to imagine anyone taking part in that kind of market without the intent of making money, right? It's a lot of effort. It costs a lot of money most of the time to go through the whole process. So if there is no revenue, it almost makes no sense. So in a lot of situations, carbon offsets are kind of described as, if there was no economic incentive to do this project, then the carbon offsets make sense, because it helps those uneconomical projects move ahead. But that is a very different goal than to say we want to make sure that the activity we're creating is really sequestering the carbon, is really removing the carbon. That's a very different proposition, right? The carbon offset is saying, well, it's uneconomical to do this, so here's some credits. What I'm trying to say is, if we actually want to do it properly, we need to set it up so that it economically makes sense to do it. And so the incentive, it's the carbon offset is no longer an incentive. It's actually paying for the removal to be done properly. So it's a little bit different.
So something they have to do, but better to get paid for. And
service, right? Yeah. If you think about waste, like municipal waste, the trash I produce as an individual, we pay somebody to come pick up our waste and to put it in the landfill. And then we have this contract, basically this social contract, that says you're going to take care of my waste. It's not going to go into the ocean. It's going to be kept in this landfill neatly, properly. For carbon, it's similar.
It goes mostly in the ocean. The yeah. recycling process too, it goes mostly in the ocean.
That's true. So in this kind of utopic world, we're going to say that we want somebody to take care of it and it doesn't end up in the ocean, right? So if we think about this end goal, this kind of system, it is a service. And if we're saying, well, maybe for carbon, we need this kind of service that somebody actually takes care of it, you know, notwithstanding whether or not it goes into the ocean, somebody needs to take care of it.
There's one service, carbon offset service. I didn't know if I have to press my body to feel if I'm sleeping or not, or if I only have to laugh loud. It's called Yep Yes. Yep You. Sorry, it's Yep You. There you can. Okay, I go to this page. I tell you a bit. You can on Yep You offset. You can offset your own breath. You can offset the breath of your pet, and all those things. There I come close to this point where I think, okay, I'm living in a satiric simulation, or what the fuck is this?
Yeah, I have not heard about this carbon offset provider. I guess it is an interesting message that they're trying to make, right? It's all about guilting people for existing. And yeah. I think that's very difficult, because putting the guilt on the individual is really not a way to actually make change, right? Because in most instances, in this particular instance, they're basically saying you shouldn't exist, right? You need to compensate for the fact that you're alive. And that's a very bleak, in my opinion, view of the role of humans in nature, and kind of suggesting that maybe humans shouldn't be part of the ecosystem. So I don't know. I feel like that's an interesting approach. But I will say that it is maybe representative of the carbon market, carbon offsets community as a whole. Like, and I mean very generally, it is the Wild West. And by Wild West, I mean anything goes, no one's checking anything. The regulations that should be in place to protect consumers don't exist. There's a lot of experimentation, I guess. And so just like this particular carbon provider, they're trying these messages that are, quite frankly, quite almost disturbing and counter beneficial. So yeah, I don't know, but it's
What's about politics? So if they can regulate it on a higher scale, a really high scale, but we know that they are not only good politicians. There are much politicians very connected to the money making system and so on and so on. Is there something you would say it's important to say, or important to make clear in politicians, politics, and carbon offset?
That's a difficult one, because in only certain markets are kind of offsets being used in the kind of regulated sense. So you have the European emission trading scheme, and then the California one, and there's a few others, and all of them right now use offsets of emission reduction. And as we've been talking for the past half an hour, there's clear problems with that. So I think the biggest message I would want regulators and politicians to be aware of is an offset really can only mean carbon removal. Otherwise, it just doesn't make sense in those legally binding you know, commitments to achieve net neutrality. It's impossible to be neutral
when
emissions are still produced, right? So one emission has to be neutralized by a removal. It can't be compensated by a reduction. That doesn't work. That doesn't balance out. And so any country who has a plan to be carbon neutral or net zero is meaningless if carbon offsets represent emission reduction. And so I think that would be the main message I would try to make clear.
It remembers me completely to the discussion in Germany about electric cars. But in the end, it tells all the people, yes, let's stay those many numbers of cars. It's all fine. We can go the way we go since industrialization, and we go it and go it and go it. You have a nice solution. Use not a fossil car, use an electric car. But we need to completely reduce the cars in the end, if we have electric or not. And that sounds to me very similar to this.
Yeah, I guess it is in some sense. Maybe the one thing I would say is like there are all these things that we need to do, like substituting fossil carbon for renewable carbon or whatever. And there are energy efficiency activities that need to be done. And ultimately, reaching the goals that we set in the Paris Agreement really means two things. It's either we completely stop producing emissions, or we have to remove anything that we produce. There is nothing in between anymore. We've completely run out of time for this kind of, we will do a little bit better every year. It's over, right? Yes. In the example I gave of an 87% chance of staying below 1.5 degrees, that's 300 gigatons of carbon, of CO2 remaining. That's 39 tons per person. And if I look at the average American, because I'm based in America, an average American produces 15 tons per year.
So there's within, not much, you know, left for the whole world.
Exactly. Mm. So it's very quickly a very difficult conversation. And so by just saying we can just substitute the way we are currently living is not going to work. And the conversation has to be much, much deeper than that. It has to really acknowledge that fundamental shifts are going to be needed no matter what.
So I think our listeners are interested in this topic, but they for sure don't have the power to change this directly. So sometimes they have to fly, they have to do something, and sometimes you can offset your carbon. And as we talked about, this is in a big scale, it's not the solution, but better to do a working carbon offset as not. Is there something you can say how someone who's not professional in this can understand with a few clicks, a few better viewing, reading, how else, whatever, to give a bit tools in the hand, how you can choose the offset that's working? So, or is it completely unclear?
Yeah. Unfortunately, the way carbon offsets are being presented makes it very difficult for the average user to be able to say what is quality and what is not. And so that has given rise to a whole new industry of people who, you know, are doing the sorting for you. And so I would say that could be a better option than trying to sort by yourself, is to go through a middleman who already has done the work of sorting what is good quality versus bad quality. But then also remember that the middleman is choosing what is good quality and bad quality, right? It's not because there is a overarching framework that says what is quality and what is not. This middleman decided this is quality, this is not. So it's really being conscious that we are right now in a situation where it is very difficult to tell. And so if on a very basic level, I would say if one has to buy offsets of emission removal and not reduction, and, you know, try to question where it's coming from, what kind of removal it's coming from. And at this point in the game, that might be the best one can do.
Do you see some other solutions, maybe on the higher scale?
Yeah, so ultimately, there's going to need to be complete reform of the carbon market system. And, you know, this could be a bottom-up kind of approach, or it could be top-down. It's unclear which way it's going to go now, but something has to change in order for carbon offsets to make sense as a climate action solution. And pushing for reform is definitely one way to go. And there are several entry points for this kind of reforming. So for example, I know that the European government, the European Council, has a program underway right now where they're trying to develop the rules for carbon removal offsets. So that might be a way to start saying, this is what it should like look like, and this is not what it should look like, and try to influence at a very high level. Similarly, there are some efforts underway in the US. There's an international effort underway. But at the end of the day, it's really questioning all of the assumptions that are being made with those rules, because they are, as we've been discussing, they're quite complex, and they take a long time to even get to the root of the problem, right? When we talk about additionality, it takes many layers of understanding before we get to, aha, this is the issue. And so with carbon offsets, time. Because all of this, and time and effort and everything. Yeah, exactly. And so because at the end of the day, we're talking about an imagined instrument, we can shape it the way we want. And so we can demand collectively as people that there is proof for any of those things that are being made into carbon offsets, right? We can start demanding for completely transparent databases that collects all of that proof. And without proof, we can say we don't want it. And I think we have come to the point where it needs to change, and the people who are changing the rules need to understand that the public also has a say in this. And I don't, maybe I could be wrong, but I would say that most people do want carbon offsets to work if they're going to purchase them, right? You don't want to purchase something that is fraud or fake. Somebody wants to purchase actual thing, sure, that does the work. So
you pay for, you won't want something back.
Exactly. So it's about customer protection, and it's about protecting ourselves from anybody who wants to game the system.
It's maybe it's a bit too far, but I have in my head the possibility. I can switch to bad view of the world. And if I have a company and I shit of the world and so on, say, it could be nice to make carbon offset, because the people feel that it costs a lot to do something about the climate change, but the people don't want to have costs. So it can be as a side effect that the people feel, no, we don't want solutions against climate change because they cost something. And I don't feel directly, as we say, we don't feel directly the result. If I buy an electric car, it's fast on the traffic light starting, and so I feel it. But this I don't feel. Is there the communication in the end?
Yeah, it's communication, and it's also making clearer who has to pay. Right now we're saying you, the individual, has to do this, and somehow you're supposed to figure it out, and somehow you don't see the benefits, right? And all of this has to change. It's, in our minds, it's kind of like, right now we're paying for, you know, a kind of like energy production, and we're paying for energy transport. but we're not paying for energy cleanup, right? And so if we start thinking about like, well, there's this piece of the price that's missing, and if we can start including this into the payment, yes, it would be more expensive, but it would also start pushing from the source of the problem, the need to clean up the electricity grid, for example. Right? So it's placing the burden of responsibility to where it belongs. Yes, it's passing the cost down, but then as an individual, I can decide, I if it's regulated properly and all the frameworks are in place and everything, you know, I see that my fossil fuel the fossil intensive products or whatever are getting more expensive, then as a consumer, I can really start picking things that are going to be cheaper because they don't use fossil fuels. And so it becomes much easier to start living a life that everybody wants to live, which is in accordance with, you know, whatever your values are and what you think needs to be done for the climate. But you also see it in your wallet, because the thing that actually does good for the world is going to be cheaper than the thing that does bad. And it's that missing part in the price that currently is making that situation that you describe, where it's like, I don't feel the difference if I do something good. Well, that's because it's priced wrong. It's priced the wrong way. You shouldn't pay more for doing good.
Yeah, that's the point. We don't talk in pricing. We don't talk about, you have with a product and it costs that point. And there's different things in. There's the production in, there's the workers in, there's the all things you need to bring a product to having it consumed from people. And in the head of the people, this is all a price. And then that's only one price that comes on top and is clear cut it from. This climate price. This is not mixed. This is comes on top for the people thinking. So you mean that it should be that it's not, hey, look, you can offset and you have to pay more, that it's included with not talking about.
Exactly. And then the thing that pollutes the most is going to be the most expensive. And you will see the benefits of doing something good because it'll be cheaper.
Yeah, the easy way, as we are assuming. Yeah. Yes, Stephanie, is there something more, I would say, maybe an open slot? For sure, we can go very deep in this. Maybe I can't, because I'm really not in those topics. You for sure could. But is there something you would say, okay, this have to be on this episode, on the podcast, on the table?
I guess it would be good to start discussing something that has become more and more kind of talked about in the public sphere, which is the whole monitoring, verification, and reporting of carbon removal. It is currently exploding in the whole climate scene, and the implications of the decisions that are being made about those topics will have long-term consequences for everybody. And so it's kind of one of those boring topics that has huge consequences.
Yeah, in the end, boring is individual. I would really love, Stephanie, to talk to you in 20, 30 years. Let's only have boring topics, because there's nothing affecting us deeply. That would be very nice, but I think wouldn't come like this.
Well, you know, I always think about if we're actually real about solving climate change, then it will happen within the next 30 years.
Pardon, repeat.
So if we are serious about solving climate change, then it will have to happen in the next 30 years.
Okay.
Yeah. And so in 30 years, we could potentially sit it down again and, you know, look back and say, this is what happened and this is how it went down. You know, so I'm pretty optimistic. Like, the change is happening now and we are driving it, and we can make a difference.
So what makes you, most people, so many people are optimistic, pessimistic. Often scientists who knows much. So you are a scientist too, climate scientist. What makes you so optimistic?
Well, don't get me wrong, we did go through a long period of very, very pessimistic outlook, right? I started as a climate scientist where I was recording the changes in the Earth temperature or processes. So I really saw like the massive dramatic changes that are underway in the Earth system. And that was really a difficult thing to look at. But now that I work on climate mitigation, and I'm really seeing the scope and the immense effort and intensity of the change that are underway from the people who, you know, who are now joining the fight, joining the change, who want change. I think that's extremely positive. And the second part is something that my colleague always says to me, is that in previous times, the, you know, societies have found themselves at the edge of like huge problems. So maybe one time it was acid rain, or it might have been deforestation, like local deforestation. And as they came closer and closer to the point where things could go really bad, they found solutions. And so I'm trying to hold on to that thought that we are coming closer and closer to the point where it's really bad, but we're going to wake up because it hurts, and we're going to do what it takes to solve it. So kind of a bleak, optimistic view, but I'm optimistic we're going to get there.
Okay, Stephanie. So today it's the 4th of October, 2022. Let's meet on the 4th October of 2052 and talk about all those solutions that's still working. Thank you.
It's all good. Thank you.
Thank you.